At last the moment had arrived for which the young men of 1914 had volunteered. Men in their 20s, in their 30s, boys in their teens, for all of them. This is what they'd trained for. This at last was the big push, the crack at the Kaiser, Fred Kanu's army showing the Boche what for. Junior officers who might have been at school the year before stood looking at their watches, whistles in their mouths as the last seconds ticked away. Now the war was no longer in the hands of the generals and the commanders, but in the hands of these young men. It was supposed to be a walkover. The Germans, after all, were not supposed to be there. They had, after all, been pounded by the greatest bombardment in history. No one, the general said, could possibly survive. But deep in their dugouts, the Germans had survived. And at the instant that the last colossal bombardment lifted toward the German reserve lines, they swarmed up from their underground shelters. And they brought their machine guns with them. Up the hill marched row upon row of heavily laden soldiers, walking steadily, doggedly forward. One soldier later recalled, "At first we strolled along as though walking in a park. Then suddenly we were in the midst of a storm of machine gun bullets, and I saw men beginning to twirl round and fall in all kinds of curious ways as they were hit."
For anyone like me that was brought up as a child in the 1970s, you'll recognise the voice there of the actor Leo McKern, who was the star of a hit television series called Rumpole of the Bailey. And in 1976, he went over to the Somme and recorded a documentary, which I've just played a part of there, when he introduces the first moments of the Battle of the Somme, the Great Push, as it was called at the time. And I do recommend that you go and watch this documentary. You can find it easily on YouTube just by typing in Battle of the Somme 1976 with Leo McKern. It puts a different perspective on the battle when you look at it, as he was doing with 60 years of hindsight. We now look at it with over 100 years of hindsight. So we've got another 40 odd years of research and information that they didn't have in the 1970s. And it's also fascinating to look, as Leo walks the battlefield, at how the Somme looked in 1976, in particular the Hawthorne crater with the tall trees that we see there now. And he filmed it, or when his film crew filmed it in the 1970s, the trees are probably only half the height that they are now. And there's lots of other interesting perspectives on the Somme battlefield for those that know it well. It's interesting to look back. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And I sat here this week with a long list of different episodes that I've been thinking about recording for some time. But then, I don't know why, but my mind, as it often does, goes back to the Somme, the battle that my great-uncle Henry died of wounds in 1916. And I decided it was about time that we heard some more words from those men that were there, or their stories of men that died on the Somme. So completely at random, I've found some stories that I've either heard or told myself on the battlefields over the years, and stories that I like to share with you this week. It's not a narrative of the Battle of the Somme. It's not an official history of the Battle of the Somme. As I've said so many times before, that's for professional historians in other podcasts and books to tell. All I'm interested in is sharing the stories of those that were there through their eyes. So let's start that, shall we? And I think what we'll do is listen to a little bit more of that documentary presented by Leo McKern in 1976. This is what he said next.
"In the excitement of the moment, some Germans stood on top of their trenches, regardless of their safety, to fire into the soldiers approaching steadily uphill. All along the British line, men could be seen throwing up their arms and falling. The advance crumpled. The waves of British infantry broke helplessly against the wall of the German defence. A young subaltern, Charles Carrington, who witnessed this first attack on the Somme, wrote that for the onlooker, battles of the First War were rarely spectacular. A great noise and a smoke cloud filled the valley, in which now and then one saw distant figures moving, aimlessly it seemed, like ants in a disturbed anthill."
Kern mentioned Charles Carrington there. He's a man who wrote prolifically about his experiences on the Western Front and the Somme in particular, and we're going to look more closely at what he had to say at some stage as well. But what I need to do now, if you'll just bear with me for a few seconds, is mention a company called Ativo that have very kindly sponsored the podcast and made a very generous donation to the Army Benevolent Fund. Ativo is a company that enriches lives through lifestyle financial planning. It's about more than just focused financial advice. It's a tailored, holistic approach centred on your unique aspirations, individual circumstances and evolving needs. By building a lifelong relationship based on trust and getting to know you, Ativo works with you to craft a bespoke financial plan that helps you live the style of life that you want. Their experienced, highly qualified financial specialists and expert support teams are committed to delivering more for all of their clients. It's clear, independent advice that sets them apart, helping their clients to unlock their unrealised financial potential, giving them the confidence to lead financially secure and enriched lives. So if you want to know more, please go to their website, which is www.ativo.co.uk. And I can recommend them from personal experience because they've been looking after my pension and investments for the last 5 years or so. And they came up with a plan that enabled me to retire from my full-time job and spend all of my time now that I have spare recording podcasts, doing battlefield tours, going around doing talks and generally devoting the time to do what I want to do with it. And that is very much needed in this period of financial uncertainty for us all. So what I want to do today, as I say, is look at a number of the individual stories. We'll see how far we get. As usual, I've got more listed here than time allows. But hopefully it will allow you to make a note of some of these stories. And when you visit the Somme in the future, take along them with you and go and visit some of the graves of the people that we're going to talk about. And one of them is in a cemetery which you quite often pass if you go to the Somme without realising it's there. As you come from Auvillay, you head down to one of the many junctions on the Somme that's called Crucifix Corner. Then you head up towards the village of Hautwil, and then beyond that, the Tietvaal Memorial. But before you get there, on the right-hand side, you'll see a green Commonwealth War Graves Commission sign pointing towards the Blighty Valley Cemetery. Now, I'm sure most people have seen this sign and have driven past because it's a little bit difficult to get to, but it's honestly well worth the effort. You have to park your car on the grass verge. There's no real official place to park. And then walk about 500 metres down a grass pathway, which is unfit for cars. You can't take your vehicle down there, not even a push bike. You've really got to get out the car and walk. But it's worth it. Now, Blighty Valley itself was given the name by the army to the lower part of the deep valley that runs southwestward through Hautwil Wood, which was used by the British in 1916. And it runs down towards the river between Hautwil and Avaloo. Now, if you'd have been here prior to the Battle of the Somme, you'd have seen Blighty Valley itself, the valley that you're walking in, full of guns that were firing on the German defensive positions. The cemetery itself was begun in early July 1916, and it was used until November. And at the armistice in 1918, there was just 212 graves there, but as with so many of them, it was greatly enlarged, with a further 784 being brought in after the armistice, bodies that they found on the battlefields and also from some of the smaller cemeteries that were closed down. And so many of the men that were there are those that died on the 1st of July 1916. In total now, there's 1,027 burials and commemorations from the Great War. And of those, 536 are unidentified. And there's another 24 special memorials to casualties that they are either known or believed to be buried there. And five others that were buried by the Germans in Bicor, German cemetery in 1918, but they couldn't find them at the end of the war, so they put special memorials in this particular cemetery. Now, in this cemetery, of course, there's lots of privates and NCOs, but there's also four lieutenant colonels that died in the early part of the Battle of the Somme, but it's not their graves that I wanted to talk about. The one that I always go and see and take people to see is one that you wouldn't normally notice. You perhaps pass the grave of Private Matthew Livesey, service number 14164, serving with the 7th Battalion of the King's Own Royal Lancaster Regiment, one of the thousands that died on the 1st of July, aged 27, and he's in plot 2, row D, grave number 4. and on his headstone, his family have put words that say he obeyed the call of duty. Nothing unusual about any of that. But what is an unusual story about him is the efforts that his family went to, not only to find out where his grave was when it wasn't easy to find that information, but also to visit the grave of their loved one. So Matthew lived in Score Lane, Bamber Bridge in Lancashire, and he played football for a team called the Higher Walton Albion, and he left that club and his family to enlist with the King's Own Royal Lancaster Regiment. No, he was one of those that I said that died on the 1st of July. He wasn't killed in combat. He died accidentally before he even had a chance to fire his gun. As his unit were marching towards the base town of Albert on the 1st of July, the ammunition that he was carrying accidentally went off. He lost his arm and his leg. He desperately tried to carry on somehow, but he died of his wounds. His comrades made their way forward, but not before they buried him on the side of the roadway. News was sent home of his sad demise, but in what was to come, the battalion lost heavily, and the survivors were unable to tell Matthew's parents, John and Susanna, and the two younger sisters, Lizzie and Hilda, exactly where they buried him. And so when the war came to an end in 1918, he had no official grave. So in 1920, his sister, Lizzie, and Father John travelled over to France with the YMCA in a bid to find out where he lay. And during the 6 days that they spent, Lizzie wrote in her diary. She met a lot of people on the journey and she wrote about their stories as well. And she met one girl that was living in a hostel where they were staying, and she'd lost the whole of her family when her house was shelled by the Germans. The soldiers somehow dragged her out of the rubble, but she got nowhere to go, so she stayed in his hostel and looked after people that were staying there. Now, as we know, the authorities did their best to clear the battlefields after the war, but there were still remnants of the fighting left behind. And in Lizzie's case, she wrote in her diary how she found a leg on the roadside. She wrote on again for about 2 more miles into the mist of what was no man's land, past piles and piles of barbed wire, shell holes big enough to hold a house, dugouts all complete with steps into the bowels of the earth. And what's this? A human leg with a stocking on. And there is a horse with his head stuck out from the ground. It must have been buried alive. I wondered where its rider was. Now, one thing that gets me about that piece of writing is that she said the human leg had got a stocking on, therefore it was a woman. What was a woman doing in the trenches? We'll never know the answer to that. It's one of the mysteries of the Somme. Now, their journey went on with her father, and she says as every new place brought hope, they were dashed as time ran out before they had to return home. And they did return home without finding his body. But 6 months later, his body was found and then reburied in its present location in Blighty Valley. The following year, Lizzie returned again, and she brought with her a wreath that she'd kept in hope. She never married or had any children. It's believed that she had a fiancé as well who died in the Great War. She died in 1976, aged 85, and was buried on the 60th anniversary of her brother's death, the 1st of July. Staying with that first day, the Battle of the Somme, we've talked various times on this podcast about the 36th Ulster Division that attacked at Teepvale, where the Ulster Tower now stands proudly in remembrance of the men that served, fought and died there. And one of those men was a man called Samuel McElfatrick. I hope I've pronounced his name right. He was born in 1881, and in 1902 he married a lady called Hessie, and they were to go on to have 5 children, one of which was born in 1914, the year that the war broke out. And like many of them, he was working as an agricultural labourer. He went to France with his battalion in October 1915, and on the 1st of July was serving with the 11th Battalion of the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers when he was killed in action. He's no known grave. He's remembered just a short distance away from where he died on the Teepvale Memorial. And we do know exactly how he died, because a letter from his comrade says that Sam had his 2 legs blown off, but he just lit his pipe and sat down in a shell hole to die. He belongs to the 11th Battalion. Obviously back home, Hesse and the children must have been heartbroken, goes without saying, doesn't it? But she wrote a poem about Sam, and this poem was published in the local paper every day on the 1st of July. And it goes something like this. My noble husband lies in his blood-soaked garments through. In a nameless grave unknown lies the heart that beat so true. He sank faint and weary amongst the famous brave, and they laid him sad and lonely all in his lonely grave. No dear one was near him to mark his soft replies. No one was near him to close his soft dark eyes. No stone marks the grave where my husband lies so lone, in a nameless grave unknown with his blood-soaked garments through. No more bugle will call our darling one. Rest, noble soldier, all in your grave unknown. But we will know you, we will find you amongst the good and true. Then you will wear a robe of white for your blood-soaked garments through. Daddy, dear Daddy, good night, good night. As I'm reading that, I think of Sam and the fact that he still has no grave, or no known grave. Perhaps he does have a grave. Perhaps they buried him in that shell hole that he lit his pipe in. As for Hesse, she later remarried. But no doubt she never forgot Sam, the man that she was married to for 14 years and had 5 children with. Now, as they waited in those trenches on the night before and made their way up to the assembly trenches, I've often wondered what went through the minds of those lads. I wonder whether, on the eve of the Battle of the Somme or the Great Push, as they knew it, whether thoughts like this went through their minds, thinking of their families and loved ones back home.
This letter, but I'm writing anyway to let you know. With pen in hand, I sit here by the campfire and hear my comrades singing soft and low. I thank you for the years of love and laughter, for consistency to me through joy and pain. And I wonder here, I love you really matters. I may never see your lovely face again. And I'm yearning for the mists of Dalriada, and I miss the lagging river flowing slow. And I hunger for your love, dear. So when the morning comes, dear, a bugle call, my darling, I must go. Well, it seems a million miles from Belfast City, from home and fire and children growing tall. At this time when fears and doubts beset me, dread night before the Battle of the Somme. And I don't know what tomorrow brings, my lovely, as I face the angry thunder of the gun. When whirling banshee shells explode above me, and the valiant men of Ulster give their blood. And I'm yearning for the mists of Dalriada, and I miss the lagging river flowing slow. And I hunger for your love, dear, 'cause when the morning comes, dear, a bugle call, my darling, I must us go. Expectations. This Gethsemane of waiting's hard to bear. But memories of you bring consolation. Well, a shiny rose beneath the tangled wire. And I need to tell you that I really love you. And I know I haven't said it for so long. My heart will hold the fragrance of your love, dear. Tomorrow at the Battle of the Somme. And I'm yearning for the mist of Dal Riada. And I miss the lagging river flow and slow. And I hunger for your love, dear, 'cause when the morning comes, dear, a bugle call, my darling, I must go.
This next story brings to life another enormous coincidence that I encountered. I think it was in 2019 or 2020. It was a cold winter's day, and with my wife, we'd gone over to the Somme. I don't know how I managed to persuade her to come with me, but she was definitely with me. And we walked from Bazentin, the village of Bazentin, up this track towards High Wood, with High Wood on the right. Like many of the tracks on the Somme, it was sunken. And in amongst the wet grass, I remember seeing, must have been half a dozen Mills hand grenades, British hand grenades, another indication of the iron harvest and the danger that lurks beneath our feet when we walk the Somme. We photograph them, we look at them, but we didn't touch them, of course. You never would you? And I also took lots of photos of that track and of High Wood, which was shorn of all its leaves, being the winter months. And then I returned home, and when I got home, I'd got an email from someone who wanted me to research a relative, not an unusual circumstance, perhaps get two or three of these a week. So I started to research this man, William Braunston, who came from the village of Moulton, not far from where I live in Northampton. And he died in the Battle of the Somme on the 15th of July 1916. So I went through the normal procedure of looking for his service record, trying to find out what information I could about William. And then when I've done all that, I turn then to the battalion war diary. Most of them have been digitised either by Ancestry or on the National Archives website. You can access them free if you register. And that's what I did. I pulled up the battalion war diary to see what his unit were doing on that day. And he was serving with the 1st Battalion of the Queen's, the Royal West Surrey Regiment. And unusually, in the battalion diary, was a hand-drawn map of the battlefield and the objectives that that battalion was attacking that day. Now, there was an enormous German trench called Switch Trench that ran for probably at least a mile, and it ran along the back of High Wood and then came out to the left and headed off towards Poitiers and Martinpuich. And it was that trench that the Queens were to be attacking that day. And when I looked at the map, there was a dotted line showing where the Queen's starting position was. And beneath the dotted line, I could see there was a farm track. and ahead of that farm track was Highwood itself, and it occurred to me that their jumping-off position on that day was the very same sunken lane, sunken farm track, that I'd walked down a few days before when I saw those Mills hand grenades in the bushes. That was exactly where William Braunston spent his last few moments, because he was killed that day. They had to cross something like 900 yards of no man's land to get up to Switch Trench, which was defended by machine guns, belts of barbed wire. They couldn't actually see the barbed wire from their own trenches because it was hidden in the long grass. As they tried to cut their way through, they were hit by machine gun fire. They tried to dig into the ground to avoid the machine gun fire. A message was sent back to HQ asking for help, but it didn't get through. Another message did get through, and the artillery started a bombardment to try and protect them. But in confusion, some of the shells fell short and landed in amongst their own men, and even behind their own original starting point. There was no way through, and just after midday, the survivors started to fall back to their original position in that lane. Just imagine the chaos, the wounded men, the confusion that there must have been in that lane that we'd walk through. The German artillery then opened up on that track, and the heavy shelling continued into the evening. They then discovered the next day that 303 men were either killed, wounded or reported missing in just that few hours, and one of those that was killed was our William. He left behind a widow called Dora and four children, all of which were under 10 years old. Chillingly, on that hand-drawn map in a battalion diary, the officer that drew it has shown the German Switch Trench in red, and he's put crosses where the barbed wire was, and then just in front of that, he's just written the words, "Battalion held up." That's where so many of those men must have fell in action on that day, including William, perhaps. Eventually, it was discovered that 71 men were killed on that day. 56 of them are still missing. They're remembered on the Tietvau Memorial. But William is not one of those that's missing. His body was found and he was buried in the Adanac Cemetery, which is perhaps a mile or so away from where he fell. He has no family inscription on his headstone that I visited during a trip about a year or so later. William was 32 years old. Now, usually, when we're carrying out research for a soldier, we go with the family after the research has been completed and we walk the place, the location where their relative died. But in this case, it was somewhat different, because just a week before, as I said, before I started the research, I walked that lane. I looked across the sloping ground where William and 70-odd of his comrades were killed, where some of them are still there, over 50 of them are probably still there. But I did that before I carried out the research. In fact, I didn't know I'd be carrying out that research. That only became apparent about 10 days later when I opened the war diary and discovered that I had been walking in the very place where that action took place. I don't know why I took that photo. I don't know what made me walk up that lane that day. It just seemed like a different thing to do, a different approach to Highwood at a different time of year to when I'd normally go. But something made me do that. And we've said this before, so many other people have said this, that the shadows and the echoes of the Somme and the other battlefields of the Great War, they're still there. And sometimes it feels as though those men that were there are still there. And they're calling out to us. They're calling out to us to come and find out what happened to them. It certainly feels like that with William. Can't prove it. Got no science to prove it. It's just a coincidence, isn't it? It's just a feeling in my bones, in my soul, I suppose. You can't explain feelings, can you? But I think of him. I think of that man, William, whenever I go anywhere near that sunken lane. I feel a close connection with him, even though obviously we never met. I have no family connection with him. The only connection is that sunken lane and the memorial that I went to see in the church in Malton, where he lived. Now, of course, we're talking about the soldiers that died in the Great War. But sometimes, I must admit, I'm guilty of forgetting about the support units, in particular, the Royal Army Medical Corps. We're going to have a whole podcast about this coming up with a lady called Helen Frost, who's written a book about this unit. But I just wanted to mention a couple of doctors that gave their lives carrying out their duty on the Somme. And all of these men that we're going to talk about in a minute were what was called the RMO, the Regimental Medical Officer. And he was a doctor that was attached to a specific infantry battalion. And he managed what was called the Regimental Aid Post, the RAP, the first port of call for any soldier that was wounded on the front line. And the RAP was as close to the front line as considered safe, usually set up in dugouts or deep shell holes or any ruined buildings. They were often very small, damp and poorly lit places. But it was in these conditions that the RMO dealt with the wounded men had been brought in by the stretcher bearers. Their treatment often ranged from cleaning shallow cuts to even amputating limbs in more serious cases. It was just a question of getting these men cleaned up and saving their lives before they could be considered well enough to go back to either a dressing station or a casualty clearing station or a base hospital further behind the lines. And this was part of the chain of evacuation that the British Army set up not long after the war began. But because these RMOs were so close to the enemy line, it meant that they were never far from danger, and so many of them became casualties themselves. The German artillery could easily reach these regimental aid posts, and the casualty rates for RMOs were very high. In 1917, it was reported per month that the death rate amongst them was as high as 40 per thousand of them. And one of those men was Captain Alfred Thompson. He was born in Brussels in Belgium in 1885, but his parents moved to Belfast. And at 17, he decided to become a doctor. After graduating, he moved to Middlesex, and he entered the profession with his first surgical position at a hospital in Maidstone in Kent. But immediately after the outbreak of war, he enlisted with the RAMC, the Royal Army Medical Corps, and he was attached to the 7th Battalion of the Royal Sussex Regiment. And in May 1915, he left England for the Western Front. And then we get to the Battle of the Somme. And it's that place, Auvillers, that was supposed to be taken on the 1st of July, but wasn't. Had another go on the 3rd of July. That attack failed. And on the 7th of July, the attack went in again. And it was here that Alfred was killed as he crossed No Man's Land, looking for the wounded while the battle was still ongoing. And if you remember, No Man's Land around Auvillers, as you approach the German-held village of Auvillers, was perhaps 800 yards wide, the widest part of No Man's Land on the 1st of July, or in this case, still on the 7th, because it hadn't been taken. Now, there was an infantry officer called Lieutenant Stocks, and he said that Alfred spent the entire time continuously attending to the wounded. Stocks himself was hit by a bullet through the right leg, just 80 yards from the British front line, and Alfred went to his aid. He used his own cane as a temporary splint. He then dragged the lieutenant back towards the British trenches on a waterproof sheet. But Stocks saw what happened to Alfred. He said this: "With entire disregard for the enemy's heavy shell and machine gun fire, he managed to haul me onto the sheet and was having me pulled to cover on his improvised sledge when he suddenly fell forward, almost on top of me, without uttering even a groan, apparently shot through the heart by a sniper." It was the day before Alfred would have been 31 years old. And as I say, he has no known grave. Maybe he's still there, but either way, he's on panel 4C at Tietvau. Another man that's on the same panel by coincidence at Tietvau is Alexander Lowe, who was born in 1875 in Angus in Scotland. And he was just 15 when he started studying medicine in Dundee at university. And in 1896, he qualified as a doctor at Edinburgh University. He then moved to Dundee, spent some time as a GP, and then became a lead surgeon at the Dundee Royal Infirmary. And in 1907, he married a lady called Ella, and they had two sons, Albert and Morris. Now, he joined the RAMC before the war in 1912, and initially he served at home when war began at a hospital in Aberdeen. But in 1915, he was sent to France. He was working at casualty clearing stations. And then he became the Regimental Medical Officer, the RMO, for the 7th Battalion of the Seaforth Highlanders. And they saw fierce fighting around Longueval and Delville Wood. Now, Alexander didn't wait for the wounded to come to him. He went out looking for them. a private in the 7th Battalion, said that Alexander walked about from one wounded man to another with utmost coolness. He was with us in the front line when one shell wounded several of us, and if anybody showed bravery and coolness, it was Captain Lowe. There was a quiet nobility in the way he did what he could have said was only his duty, and one was forced to wonder at it even in the heat of action. But during these brave actions on that day, the 14th of July 1916, he was killed when a shell hit him directly on the head. His body was never recovered, as I said, and he's on Teepvale. And the other one that I wanted to mention was a Reginald Wooster, who was born in 1886 in Chiswick in Middlesex. And he took up his medical studies at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington. He qualified in 1911, and by August of 1914, he joined the Royal Army Medical Corps, and the following year, he went over to France and served at one of the big base hospitals in Rouen. And then he joined the 43rd Field Ambulance a few months later and found himself getting closer to the front line. And then just before the Great Push, the Battle of the Somme, he became the RMO for the 9th Battalion of the Rifle Brigade. And he also saw action at Delville Wood and the Battle of Fleurs-Corcelette. And it was in that battle at Fleurs that he was killed in action. Now, as we said before, it was usually down to the battalion stretcher bearers to bring the casualties back in to the aid station. But not with Reginald, no. His commanding officer said, "The last I saw him, he was busy dressing the wounded after crossing the first line of German trenches. After that, he must have gone right forward, and I hear that he was working magnificently when he and his medical orderly were both killed instantly by a shell." Another officer wrote to his family back home, and he said, "I know you'll have pride in the fact that he fell when working right out in the open, and nearly a mile inside what had been German ground less than an hour before. It is not every medical officer who volunteers to go right forward, just as he did." Like the other two medical men, he has no known grave, is remembered on the Teepvale Memorial, and in total there are 132 men of the Royal Army Medical Corps that are remembered on the largest memorial to the missing anywhere in the world, on the Teepvale Memorial. This next story is a story of survival, really, a man that was convinced that he was living a charmed life, and the evidence that I'm just about to share with you perhaps proves that was the case. And his name was Edward Palmer, and he lived in Kettering in Northamptonshire. And the Northamptonshire local newspaper reported that he considered himself to be an extremely lucky man because he'd had two exceptionally narrow escapes since he'd been at the front line serving with the Northamptonshires, the first Northamptonshires. He joined the regiment in June of 1913, so he found himself out on the Western Front in the early battles of Mons and the retreat to the Marne. And up in the autumn, he was fighting in the First Battle of Ypres. And he sent a photograph of his water bottle back home to his parents in Kettering. And sticking out of it was a German bullet that had hit the water bottle. And in his view, during this night attack that he was involved in, it had saved his life, because it was the water bottle that was damaged and not him. And his commanding officer had allowed him to send that water bottle home to his parents as a keepsake and maybe a good luck charm. I wonder if they replaced it with another water bottle. I suppose there was plenty of them lying around, wasn't there? But he said in his letter that wasn't the only escape he'd had, because on another occasion he'd been hit by a piece of shell, but it was a spent shell, maybe fired from many miles away, and it caused nothing but a bruise. And he finishes off the article, he says, "Surely in the circumstances it can be said that my life is a charmed one." And then how does that affect him on the Somme? Well, 2 years later, he's 18th of August 1916, he suffers potentially a much more serious wound, because his service record says head wound caused by a bullet being fired at point blank range. But he survived that. He survived to tell the story. Obviously, he's evacuated from the trenches. He goes back to the United Kingdom for treatment. And in his service record in 1922, he's in hospital still in Nottingham. So this is what? 6 years after being shot in the head, he's still being treated, not so much for the physical wound, but he's still suffering from shell shock. He's having fits and tremors, his hands are shaking. So he's still alive, he's survived being hit, what, three times now. He doesn't ever go back to the front line, but he does live. And he lives until 1996, when he dies at the grand old age of 99. Decades after being hit in the head, decades after that bullet lodged in his water bottle, and decades after being hit by that shell, he lives almost to the century, but not quite. Hopefully, he lived a full and rewarding life, and hopefully he got over the effects of being hit, shot in the head at short range, and the psychological damage that it must have left on that young man. So going back to the documentary from 1976 with Leo McKern, he talks about a story which I'm going to do a full podcast on, and that's an officer called William Neville. Just listen to how Leo describes what happened opposite Montauban on the 1st of July 1916.
It was a day of much bravado on the British side. Opposite Serre, the Germans were astonished to see an English officer calmly leading his men into battle, wielding nothing more lethal than a walking stick. And here in these open fields between Mametz and Montauban occurred an event which was to become legendary. Captain Wilfred Neville, East Yorkshire Regiment, temporarily attached to the 8th East Surreys, conceived the idea of launching his battalion's two leading companies into the attack as though it were a football match. As the whistles blew for 0 hour, they kicked two footballs out into no man's land. Neville and his men followed. Neville himself, an eyewitness said, smoking and joking as he walked. But it was not merely an exhibition of English coolness. In Neville's idea, there was an elementary psychology, in that it gave the men something homely and familiar to concentrate on as they went over the top. This escapade was to be taken up enthusiastically by the press and to do great things for civilian morale. The Illustrated London News gave a double-page spread to their war artist, Mr. Caton Woodville. His drawing was even reprinted by the Germans, who, in captions printed in a dozen languages, mocked the event as an example of English absurdity. But Touchstone, poet of the Daily Mail, gave it the accolade of a poem, entitled, with distinct echoes of the public school spirit, The Game.
On through the hail of slaughter, where gallant comrades fall, where blood is poured like water, they drive the trickling ball. The fear of death before them is but an empty name. True to the land that bore them, the Surreys play the game.
But Captain Neville did not live to enjoy his unexpected international fame. He lay dead just short of the German line.
One of the footballs was inscribed, "The Great European Cup, the final, East Surreys versus the Bavarians, kick off at 0. Two of those footballs are held in museums. One's in the National Army Museum in London, and the other one is in the Queen's Regimental Museum in Canterbury in Kent in England. As for Neville himself, well, his body was found that day, and he's now buried not far from where he fell at the Carnoy Military Cemetery. And as I said a few minutes ago, his story is absolutely fascinating. There's much more to it than the football story. A book has been written about him by a lady called Ruth Harris. And at some stage, we're going to do a full podcast all about Billy, who he was, the letters that he wrote home, and exactly what happened to him and his regiment on that day. But that's for another day, another story. Now, this next story touches on the Somme, but not in 1916, in 1918. And it concerns two brothers from Northampton, where I live, Victor and George Corcoran. Typical lads, they worked in the boot and shoe industry before the war. They came from a working class family and they lived in a place called Devonshire Street in the district of St James. Now, Devonshire Street doesn't exist anymore, which is probably a good thing when we think about what happened down that road. When war broke out in 1914, both of them joined up and they were placed in the 1st Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. George had previously served in the same battalion, but he'd been discharged in 1910, so he was called back from reserve. And within a few weeks, George was wounded. He wrote a dramatic letter home to his parents explaining how he'd been wounded. And we get an idea of the character of these two lads from the letter that he wrote. He said he crawled into a barn and for 3 days he lay unconscious. There were all stray bullets that killed and wounded us. We killed hundreds of them and captured thousands of the dogs. I will have another cut at them when I'm better. It is their artillery that does the damage, but ours soon wiped them out. There's only about 400 of our regiment. I fought at Mons and every other battle, and I never thought there was a bullet for me after that. Now, he's talking there about fighting in the Battle of Mons, but he didn't arrive on the Western Front until a week later. So he was definitely wounded on the Western Front, but not in that battle, he couldn't have been. The following year, Victor was badly wounded during the Battle of Loos. His wound was so bad that his leg was amputated and he was discharged from the army. Now, George, he soon recovered from his wounds, but he found himself in bother with the army 3 times. On one occasion, he was confined to barracks for 14 days for not putting the lights out when ordered. And the second part of the charge read, making an improper remark to the NCO. So you can see what's happened here. He's been told by perhaps a sergeant or sergeant major or someone to put the lights out, and he's told him where to go, hasn't he? That's what's happened. But he did return to the front line. He was wounded twice more. And when he was home, recovering from a severe arm injury, he married a lady called Laura. And in August 1918, this is the connection with the Somme, he joined this time with the 6th Northants and took part in the crossing of the River Ancre during the 100-day offensive. And he was wounded again, this time in the thigh. And it was so bad that, like his brother, his leg was amputated. He was treated at a military hospital in Richmond Park in Surrey. And of course, that was the end of his action on the Western Front. But his scrapes with the discipline of the army were not over. He was fined 9 days' pay for being absent in January of 1919. So both of these two lads, Victor and George, they returned to Devonshire Street missing a leg. But their exploits didn't end there, not by a long way. Victor, he lodged with his brother and their wife. However, they must have fallen out at some stage because he ended up in court for trying to set fire to his brother's property. On another occasion, Victor was fined £10 for threatening George and Laura with a poker, a fire poker. Well, as for George, he got himself into trouble as well because there was a local pub called the Florence Nightingale. And in 1924, he was in trouble with the authorities for hitting a Mr. Edwards over the head. And what did he use to hit Mr. Edwards over the head? He used his walking stick that helped him get around, of course, because he'd got a leg missing. He claimed in court it was an accident and he didn't realise that Edwards was so close when he was swinging his stick around in the air. He was found guilty of assault and fined £1. I mentioned earlier that Victor had been in trouble for using the poker. The newspaper said that he was charged with being drunk and disorderly. P.C. Annis said that he found the prisoner in a house in Devonshire Street threatening his brother and his brother's wife with a poker. The witness took the poker from him and he then rushed at his brother. He did not live in the house. He was ejected and advised to go to his father's house, which was a few doors away. His father, who he'd previously tried to assault, refused to have him in and he was taken into custody. The prisoner, who said that if he had not fetched the policeman, he would not be where he is now, was fined £10. And this was his 5th appearance in the court. As I said, both Devonshire Street and the Florence Nightingale pub and all the stories that come from that area of Northampton were demolished long ago. As you know through listening to my rambles, the Somme holds a very special place in my heart because that's where my great uncle fell in 1916 and my grandfather also served there. And it's a place that draws me back time and time again. And it's where all of these stories up to now come from. There really does seem to be something in the soil, something in the air of that area of France. The final two stories today take us elsewhere. This is another lad from Northampton, a man called Arthur Pearson. He was serving with the 1st Battalion of the Middlesex when he was killed in action just a couple of weeks before the end of the war on the 23rd of October 1918. And he's buried in a place called Monte British Cemetery. But then the local newspaper reported that there was an awful coincidence on that day because his was the 3rd death in that family in 7 weeks. He'd lost a brother in 1915. His name was James. But the ironic coincidence of that day was that back home in Northampton, his mother, Harriet, had passed away aged 60 years old. She wouldn't have known, of course, that Arthur had died. Arthur wouldn't have known that his mum died. But they did. They both died on the same day. Maybe subconsciously she did know. What an awful coincidence for the rest of the family to have to deal with. 2 weeks later in Northampton, there were great celebrations as the armistice was declared. Flags were being waved on the streets of the town. Parties were going on. The munition workers down tools and everyone celebrated wildly. But I'm sure that family didn't, because they were not just missing two sons that had died in the Great War, but the mum that had also died on the same day as her son. And our final story today takes us back up to Ypres and to the Menin Road South Military Cemetery. And then there you'll find Lance Corporal Ernest Warner, service number 14427, serving with the 7th Battalion of the North Ants, who died at Hoog on the 21st of January 1916, aged 24. His family chose the simple words "at rest" as his family inscription on his headstone. So what could happen at Hoog in 1916, January, in that cold winter? Battalion diary is very quiet about what happened. It says, still unfavourable weather for enemy gas. Work on the night of the 21st, 22nd was continued by Royal Engineers and our own men. The wire in front of our trenches strengthened and traverses built up. This work is necessarily gradual, otherwise the enemy observes too much progress and shells more frequently. But during that work that was going on, there was a terrible accident. Ernest was there, and also with him was his brother, Alfred. But something awful happened, because Ernest was accidentally shot by one of his own comrades, who was at that time unloading his rifle, and within 15 minutes he died in the arms of his brother, Alfred. The two brothers had enlisted together at the outbreak of war in September 1914, and they'd been out on the front only for a few weeks. He was 24 years old on that day. It was his birthday. The day that he died, not through enemy shell fire or a sniper or machine gun fire, he died in an awful accident. His brother Alfred did live through the war, he survived the war, but at some stage he'd been gassed and he never recovered from that, and he died in 1941, and he was aged just 46. So this week, what we've done, we haven't looked at a particular battle. Yes, we focused on the Somme, but we've not been looking at any particular actions on the Somme. These are just stories of young men that went off and in many cases didn't come back home again. The stories of people that make up the wars, that make up the battles. It's not about the artillery or the generals or the governments. It's about the people, isn't it? That's what makes us so interested. That's what made me so fascinated by the Great War when I was just a young boy. And that's what gave me the idea of recording this podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. So once again, thank you very much for tuning in. Listening numbers seem to increase, not just the recent episodes, but the back catalogues, over 100 of them now. And new listeners seem to be picking up on them, which is great news. So please do continue to rate and review the podcast from wherever you get them from. In particular, Apple and Spotify, they seem to be the two most popular ways of downloading the podcast. I don't know what we're going to do next week, but we'll be back at some stage. And in the meantime, we'll remember, as usual, all of the men that we talked about this week by the playing of The Last Post.